supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a topic that's difficult to bring up, but I would be remiss if I didn't with cold weather coming on, because I don't want you to make any tragic mistakes that lure rats close to your home. I'll tell you what not to do and what to do if things go bad in the question of the week. We're also going to talk to our old friend Bill Quarles from the BIRC about a disturbing new trend in genetically modified food crops. That's a lot to do, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Holly, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Holly. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm great, now that I'm talking to you.
And where is Holly great?
I live in Santa Barbara, California.
Oh, our good friends in Southern California. It's so great to be on the air there. What can we do for Holly in sunny Santa Barbara?
I'm a great gardener. I'm Italian. I grow my own vegetables. I've got a lot of success this summer. We've had some really good hot weather, but I can't seem to grow rhubarb.
Ah.
And the frustrating thing is my neighbors have it, and they have a wonderful whole plot of it. So I've planted at least 5 plants, 3 of which were plants and the others were, I'm not sure, you don't call them bulbs, but they were crones or anyway, and they grew. And I made rhubarb pie, rhubarb jam, all kinds of things, and then they died.
Yes.
One by one, they died.
That's what's to be expected. Now, rhubarb is a crop that requires a chilling period, like some fruit trees, like blueberries. And typically, the advice for people like you, and people like you would also be people down in southern Florida, anywhere in the deep south where you don't get those really cold winters, is to grow rhubarb as an annual, believe it or not,
and
like tomatoes, and just start it fresh every year. Do you suspect that your neighbors have somehow come up with a secret of growing it perennially, or is it possible that they're just buying fresh plants and growing it out every year?
The former, not the latter. They have a really nice, probably 5 foot by 2 feet, and maybe even 4.5 feet high. Just, it's like a little, but they have a very open area. There's nothing really next to it.
There's two things going on. First, it's the chilling requirement. And unless they're growing down in a low spot where cold air settles, because your nights can get pretty chilly there in the winter. It goes all the way down to 55, as I remember.
considered a low chill area.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But if you have an area that collects cold air, you would plant the opposite of a northerner. You would seek out that area for fruit trees or to try to grow a blueberry bush or to plant your rhubarb, something that would collect the cold air as opposed to a high spot, which we would be looking for in the north to avoid frost issues. So take a look at where they're growing and see if there might be something climactic that you could imitate. We're only talking about perhaps the difference of 5 degrees between being an annual plant and a perennial plant. I will add that there are certain varieties of rhubarb that have either been bred or that simply do better in warm climates. Do you know what type, what variety name you...
It was called Cherry Victoria.
The word cherry is good. There should be a variety called Cherry Red.
Okay.
And that is supposed to be the rhubarb that takes the warmest weather.
Oh, good. Okay.
You know, because it's funny, it's easier to keep plants well insulated than it is to keep them cold. I have all these stupid ideas in the back of my head, like you should throw ice at it all winter long or something. But see if you can find a cool area, an area that's lower than the rest of your property, where the cold air would settle on a chilly night, and plant your rhubarb there. Try to keep it away. You don't want it to be south-facing. You don't want it to be in an area that heats up. You would want it to be in the area that heats up last in the wintertime. For instance, a spot that's low and faces north and gets the sun last, that may impart enough chilling hours to the root, especially if you can seek out the variety Cherry Red, which I'm led to believe is the best at this, and think low and cool and the last sun in the winter time. And you may work it out. And then, of course, don't be afraid to use this to start up a conversation with your neighbors about, hey, how do you do this? You know, technically it's supposed to be very difficult.
Thank you very much. This is going to be fun.
All right. Good luck. Gardening should always be an adventure.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Don, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Don, how are you, sir?
We're good, doing good in Newbro, North Carolina, close to the coast.
Excellent. Beautiful place down there. What can we do for you, Don?
I have some questions about crepe myrtle. We have a fair amount in our yard, and there are two by the driveway that are relatively dwarf, but they've been there 15 years, and they're 10 to 15 feet tall, and they're growing over the driveway, so we hit them coming in and out, and it's hard to see sometimes. So we're wondering what time of year to trim them.
Well, okay, so the crepe myrtles, you say you're hitting them, but that's because there's multiple trunks and you want to remove a couple of trunks.
No, not really. All we want to do is just remove some branches about finger size to maybe finger and a half size so that we won't hit them going in and out of the driveway.
And they're in full bloom right now.
It's really interesting. One of them is they bloom late and the other has started to lose the leaves. It's only about half the size of the other and it doesn't look happy at all. But these particular kind, as you know, there are many kind, but these have late blooms and have started to lose their leaves already.
I would have expected them to be, like, fully in bloom right now.
We have lots of crepe myrtles around here that are, like, down at the beach and this and that, that are unbelievably in full bloom. These, maybe it's because they're dwarf, I don't know. Well, they bloom late and don't bloom as long as the other ones.
Have you ever pruned them?
No.
Oh, okay. That's one reason for the lack of spectacular blooms. There's a lot of misunderstanding about crepe myrtles. You know, of course, not to commit crepe murder.
Right.
Where you cut the plants back almost to the ground. But a lot of people take it too far, and they never trim the crepe myrtle. And I think it's been really well established by researchers and horticulturalists that when you do give them even just a little haircut in the late winter, early spring, you get many more flowers as a result. So
okay, we didn't know that.
The basic answer is the best time to prune crepe myrtles is in the late winter, early spring, as soon as they start blooming again. That is the safest time. That's the time when they can recover the easiest. You could also prune them, I would think, safely if you're anxious to get this over with. I would urge you to leave them alone for another couple of months. But I would think after Christmas, I mean, I know you have a very mild climate, but you still have a kind of a winter. And I would say once we get into like the first week of January, those plants are going to be dormant. And that would be almost as safe for the plants as doing it when they start regrowing. A plant is never stronger, for instance, than when it starts regrowing in the spring. That's when it has all the muscle to heal pruning cuts right away. Now you don't want to do it because it would interfere with dormancy. And you say there's one little sick willy, right? There's one that just doesn't do as well as the others?
Right, it just doesn't look as well.
I would wait until the spring. Make sure that you give that one every little shot it has at surviving and thriving. And when you cut them back, typically what you do is you cut them back by 2 or 3 feet.
Okay.
The idea, the classic way, the best way to prune crepe myrtles to keep them in a nice shape is every spring to cut them back by the amount they grew the year before so that they magically always remain the same height. Now, you've got a lot of wiggle room. For instance, if you like them the height they are, cutting them back by a foot will still really increase the bloom and the vigor of the plant.
Okay.
If you need to slowly start reducing their size and they're like 10, 15-foot trees, no harm whatsoever taking off 3 or 3.5 feet.
Okay.
But if you want to do more than that, you do it over a couple of seasons.
Okay.
But again, the ideal is you take off about 2 or 3 feet every spring. That way the flowers stay right where you want to see them. And guaranteed, once you prune these things, you're going to see lots more flowers.
Okay.
Just don't prune them now because they're trying to go dormant. But once we get into the winter, if you can't wait any longer, do it then. Otherwise, the absolute best time is as soon as you see the new growth in the spring.
Okay, that's great. I didn't know a lot of that. I really am glad I called you, and we love your show. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. We love being on the air there.
All right, bye now.
Take care.
All right.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at a very special WHYY member event at Springdale Farms in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, this Thursday evening, September 27th. At the TEDx event at the Colonial Theater in Phoenixville, PA on Saturday, October 6th, and at the Mount Laurel, New Jersey Library on Sunday, October 7th at 1 and 3 p.m. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, a disturbing new trend in genetically engineered plants, and how to keep vicious vermin away from your family. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Folkways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
Coming up at noon today on WHYY-FM, it's Left Behind, Dropping Out. This special tackles the national high school dropout crisis. Then from 1 to 6 on WHYY-TV, we continue to help students keep on the path to graduation during the American Graduate Telethon. So tune in to WHYY today.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a topic that may test you because it's difficult to listen to, it's difficult to think about, but it's critically important to know the things you need to do as cold weather approaches to keep rats far away from your home and family. But right now, it's time to talk to our non-ratty friend, Dr. Bill Quarles, director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California, and for the purposes of today's show, editor of the IPM Practitioner, a great journal devoted to monitoring the field of pest management. Bill, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing really lousy, Bill, because I have read the lead article in the latest issue of the IPM Practitioner, and it's terrifying. You are writing about what you are explaining is happening in the world of food crops. There's no other word than terrifying or horrifying.
Well, that's one way to look at it. The other way is that it's possible to make some changes. Genetically engineered crops right now are in the news because I think agriculture is at a critical point. The USDA is set to approve a number of the new GE crops, and some of them may cause environmental damage due to increased pesticide applications.
And that's exactly why we want you on the show. That's the point of the lead article in the latest issue of the IPM Practitioner. When genetically engineered crops were first proposed, we were told that they would lead to better yields and fewer pesticide uses. But in reality, a large percentage of these genetically engineered crops are genetically engineered to endure massive amounts of old-school chemical herbicides, right?
That's right. And there's something that is really, I think, really disturbing about that, because you plant the crop in the field and then you really don't do much. You wait for the weeds to come up and then you go over with an airplane and just spray the whole field and the crop. To me, there's something a little bit disturbing about hitting a crop with herbicides.
In your article, you even say that these genetically engineered crops take up the herbicide and that the herbicide is actually systemically in the crop. And so that when you eat that corn or soybean, you're eating the herbicide. How is that possible? I'd never heard
that.
Well,
glyphosate, as you know, is a systemic herbicide. You know, you spray it on the leaves of a weed, and it translocates to the roots. So it's systemic. It stays in the plant. And so if you spray, for instance, soybeans with glyphosate, the plant absorbs the glyphosate, and then it is translocated throughout the plant, and some of it ends up in the soybeans.
But you're talking about genetically engineered soybeans, because if you crop dusted a field of real soybeans, should such a thing still exist, they would all die, right?
That's right. There'd be no problem. The crop would just die.
Now, the statistics you have in here, the pesticide use for GE crops over the past 16 years has increased by 400 million pounds of pesticide applied?
Yeah, and the reason for that is that you have to use a lot of glyphosate in order to kill weeds.
So in the old days,
let's
say you're a conventional farmer and you're growing regular soybeans, but you don't mind using herbicides. You're trying to avoid hitting your crops, and you're trying to just target the weeds, and you're using the smallest amount possible.
That's right.
So that you don't hurt the soybeans. But
That's right. And that's why there's an increase with the genetically engineered crops. Is in the past, you'd use spot treatments or whatever. But when you're just actually just dousing the whole field, I think the figure is a 94% increase in herbicide use in corn and soybeans.
And, Bill, these crops were originally approved on the promise that they were going to cut pesticide use. Has anybody gone back and said, hey, what about this old promise?
I think that retrospect is one of those things you don't go into in this business. It seems like it anyway, is that people have short-term memories that are not very effective.
Now, I hadn't realized the volume, the scale of what to me is an enormous agricultural problem. Your research found that in 2008, 92% of the soybeans grown in America were genetically engineered?
That was surprising to me as well, because I had no idea when I started this article how prevalent the use of these crops is.
Soybeans, it's like a hippie food. It's what you make tofu from.
That's right. And so basically, if you eat soybeans, unless you eat organic soybeans, you're eating genetically engineered soybeans.
And according to the research that you're citing, you're getting little bits of herbicide in those soybeans and
tofu.
That's
right. In California, they have it on the ballot. I mean, that at least the crops would have to be labeled. And so that when you buy food, if it passes in California, then if it's genetically engineered, it would have to be labeled. So your cornflakes would have to be labeled genetically engineered.
And I believe you cited a survey that said 90% of Americans want such labeling, but politically it's always been quashed, right?
Yeah, politically it's always been quashed, and part of the reason is a lot of money goes to try to suppress these movements to get stuff labeled.
And as California goes, not always, but sometimes the nation, the basis of the definitions for organic food in America today came from California, the state of California.
Yeah, not only that, you know, if they have to do it in California, if they have to label the cornflakes in California, then how do you know? Does it stop at the border? I mean, are you going to change your printing press and produce one product for the rest of the country, and then you just print labels for California?
As you point out in all the different research you read and your citations, the weeds in these fields are becoming resistant to the herbicide, so they have to use more herbicide. And eventually there's going to get to a tipping point where the farmers can't get a good enough price for these crops to pay for all the chemicals they're dropping on them, right?
That's right. That's right. The profit is being eaten up by more and more inputs.
Is that one of our best hopes for the future, that the heroism of these weed plants and their fighting back will make it economically unpopular to use these genetically engineered crops, and maybe we can go back to the future and be growing real food again?
That would happen, except that the corporate solution is to produce these new crops that are resistant to other herbicides, and so it's like a pesticide treadmill. If a farmer wanted to forget organic for a moment, but just wanted to grow it like it was in 1990, they would have a hard time finding seeds that are not genetically engineered and not treated with systemic chemical pesticides.
Now, every year we get emails of people saying that they're seeing fewer monarch butterflies. And in the past, I'd wonder what was going on, or just, you know, seasonality, El Nino, changes in the overwintering habitat of these remarkable butterflies. One of the things that's mentioned in this article, and you've got it cited six times sideways, is the monarch butterfly is collateral damage of this farming practice.
That's right, because in the Midwest, the milkweed is growing right near the fields. In other words, right along the edges of the corn fields. In the old days, that wasn't affected because you would be doing conventional sprays of glyphosate or whatever. But when you're doing an aerial spray, well, you're getting the whole field and then some. And so the stands of milkweed that were supporting these Midwest populations have been destroyed. Milkweed, unfortunately, is one of the weeds that you can kill pretty well with glyphosate.
And, of course, it is the sole plant that the caterpillar, the monarch butterfly, needs to feed on, not only to feed on, but to become toxic to predators like birds so they can survive.
That's right. As far as I understand, they're dependent on that particular plant.
All right, Bill, no good news here. No bright paintbrush to end this with. No monarch butterfly and savior in your pocket or anything like that?
The bright thing, as far as I'm concerned, is organic agriculture and the fact that it seems to be improving, and maybe that will become the new conventional. The conventional agriculture will be organic.
Bill, I can't thank you enough for paying attention to this topic, for reporting on this topic, for reading all the journals, for doing all the research, for the endless citations in your articles. I know your facts are correct, and you've been doing this. You've been carrying your part of this for 25 years now at the BIRC, and the work you've done is tremendously important, and this may be the most important issue you ever put out. We're speaking with Bill Quarles, director of the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. You can find them on the web at BIRC.com. BIRC.org. The BIRC and Bill Quarles publishes and edits two excellent journals. One is called Common Sense Pest Control. The one we're speaking about today is the IPM Practitioner. That's the special issue Bill has done on the new genetically engineered herbicide-resistant crops. Bill, it's tremendously good work you're doing. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Mike.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Brody, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Brody, how are you?
I'm hot.
And where is Brody hot?
I'm in Waco, Texas.
Oh, you're one of my friends from the radio station.
Yes, sir.
And what are your call letters again?
KWBU.
That's right. One of the first stations to put us on the air. And you were, I don't know if it's kind that you invited me to Waco, Texas, and what was it, late July that for an event that year?
Well, that's when our anniversary falls, so it just happened to be in July. We weren't trying to be mean.
I do remember.
It was a great event. We loved having you here.
Yeah, I especially liked the fact that the event was literally held underground.
That's true.
Yeah, that was a good place to be. So what's up in Waco, Brody? What can we do for you?
Well, I have no kind of green thumb at all. I'm lucky to keep an ivy alive in my house, but I'm actually calling about a yard question. I have a huge oak tree in my front yard, and I'm very, very thankful for the shade that it provides to help my electric bill stay low. However, this tree drops leaves, I feel, year-round, and I think that it's just suffocated my yard out. I have very little grass, a lot of dirt. The drought that we had last year and the drought that we have had this year, I have some shrubbery that lines the front of my house. The shrubs underneath the tree, I believe, survived because of the shade. The shrubs that were in front of my front window were just cooked, and I've recently had those cut down to nubs, but a few sprouts have come back. I actually like the window better with nothing there. So my question is twofold. How hard would it be to dig up the almost dead shrubbery, and should I do that, and maybe put a bird bath and just some low maintenance grass or pebbles, something there? And what would be the best kind of grass to treat my yard with to get my yard looking halfway decent, something that's going to thrive in the shade and then also for the portions that are just baked by the sun?
Well, see, one of the things that people have the hardest time understanding is when they have a big tree and they want to grow grass under it, all they can focus on is the tree is throwing down a lot of shade, which is true. And as you've noticed, there are trees, especially in your kind of Baroque climate where it's hot all the time and the summers are like primeval, trees can drop their leaves at any time. And once those leaves, a collection of them, lays on top of the ground, they turn into a nice mat and they'll kill grass. But what people fail to understand is look up at the canopy of the tree. Look at every branch and how far it goes out. Well, there's a mirror image of that underground, and that entire root system has first crack at any water that does enter your yard and any nutrients that are in the soil. So typically, in the more extreme conditions, it becomes more and more difficult to grow a lawn of any kind under trees. And it's totally unnatural. As you know, if you go out in the woods, you don't see any grasses at all. Those aren't the kind of plants that have evolved to survive under trees. Plus, you're in a very hot climate. So, first of all, you would only be looking at warm season grasses. You would only be looking at grasses that you would install in the spring, not in the fall, the way okay. We would do it here in the north. So that's good. If you decide you want to pursue this foolhardy idea, you have 6 months to plan for it. But I would instead suggest you do a little research on xeriscaping, which is X-E-R-I. It's a bizarre word, and it really is planting for areas that you know are going to be hot and dry most of the time. And xeriscaping does not have to be, as you kind of implied, three or four little plants interspersed by sand and the occasional bleached cattle skull. There are many plants that have very low water needs, that don't have a lot of light requirements, and that can survive underneath a big tree like that. And then, yes, take a good look at the front of the house. Your experience with your shrubs dying and you suddenly seeing the front of your house and you going, you know, I kind of like this, is what a lot of people go through. We tend to overplant a lot of times. And when we've been in a place for a while, we often improve the landscaping by taking stuff out rather than by adding stuff in. And I'm going to suggest, if you've got this dominant specimen tree that is giving you shade and coolness and all these ecological benefits, and we're going to have this low-growing ground cover underneath it that you can walk on that'll complement it, that you do something complementary to that and keep the plants in the front of the house low-growing. There's some really nice low-growing native grasses you can get that are native to Texas. With your climate, the extremes and that I experienced, you are a classic case for native plants.
Okay.
Because they can take your temperature extremes. But I think that would be a plan that would work well. When I think of your climate, I think of stuff that stays low to the ground, that doesn't have a lot of water needs, and that complements each other. And then you've got this massive tree that I'm sure people in your neighborhood would kill for.
Well, I am going to do my research then, and I will let you know.
Please say hi to all my lovely listeners in Waco for me.
We sure will. Thank you so much, Mike.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and deliver the heartbreaking news that the time has come for vegetable gardeners in all but the warmest climes to start pulling off any new flowers that form on their tomatoes. Peppers, eggplants, too, and other crops whose fruits take a long time to mature. Why? There's no chance that those flowers are going to have enough time to become full-size fruits, and pulling them off now will signal the plants to ripen up the fruits that are already on the plant. But don't go crying in your organically brewed beer just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to keep vermin far, far away from your home. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
Don't forget to join us at noon today on WHYY for our special program, Left Behind, Dropping Out. It tackles the national high school dropout crisis. And also, you can double your support to WHYY at no cost to you. Find out if your employer will match your donation to WHYY. Visit whyy.org/matching.
Bartlett Tree Experts supports WHYY and offers the removal of hazardous trees and scientific treatments including pruning and disease diagnoses. Locations in Montgomery, Chester, and Bucks counties and Cherry Hill, New Jersey. More information at bartlett.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a difficult topic to talk about and to think about, but you have to know what you're doing as we get into the cooler months to make sure you don't accidentally invite vermin to nest near or, God forbid, inside your home. We'll tackle this very important topic after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Dan, how are you, sir?
Terrific.
And where is Dan Terrific?
Long Beach Island, a little town called West Creek, right off of LBI.
Okay, very good. How could you not be terrific in a beautiful locale like that? What can we do for Dan in the Garden State?
Mike, I've got a very difficult problem with green caterpillars on my tomatoes. I've also got some kind of a wilt that's going on, and it's starting at the bottom up, and really it's destroying the plant, and the tomatoes are falling right off the plants. It's mainly affecting the San Marzano tomatoes, but the plants are very, very healthy. I mean, I've got some that are over 9.5 feet tall, but these between the wilt and the green caterpillars, it's really making a mess of it out there in a garden that I've spent, you know, the better part of a year preparing, obviously, for the season.
Okay, so let's start off with the caterpillars. This has been, by all accounts, a very bad year for tomato hornworms. These are very large caterpillars. These are some of the largest caterpillars that we get in North America, and they eat massive amounts of plant material. I actually had them on one of my tomatoes, a container, by the way, that's by my street light, which means that I probably attracted the night flying moth that laid the eggs. And this just had a small tomato cage, and the tomato plant was going out the top. I thought it was a deer. They were eating so much.
Wow.
Plant material. But then I saw their frass, the $20 word for bug poop at the bottom. And then once you see that, sometimes it's still hard to find the caterpillar. But I managed to pull them off and got rid of them, and the plants quickly recovered. But if this becomes an issue and you have other pest caterpillars around, there is no downside to spraying the plants with BT. The old version of Bacillus thuringiensis. It's totally non-toxic to anything other than caterpillars that eat the sprayed leaves. Very safe to use. It's been around for like 50 years, available under brand names like Dipel and Thuricide. But the caterpillars, the hornworms, are not causing your wilt. Now, is this the first year you've grown tomatoes in this spot?
It's actually probably 5 or 6 years.
Well, then you know what's happening.
There's something in the soil, I guess.
Yes, something natural that builds up on the soil when you grow tomatoes in the same spot year after year. With you being in New Jersey, more than likely it's verticillium wilt versus fusarium, which is the wilt that's predominant in warmer climates. But it doesn't matter. You don't need to remember those Latin words. What you need to remember is that if you keep planting tomatoes in the same spot year after year, this wilt will build up. And the classic, that's why it's called wilt. You know, the two classic signs are the tomato plant wilts, and almost always the leaves start to yellow on the bottom and the yellowing moves up the plant. And that's the sign that it's simply time to rotate to make sure that you don't grow tomatoes in the same spot next year. You want to move your tomatoes to a different spot, grow other plants in that spot for a couple of years, and the soil should recover.
It's a terrible shame because it's such a good spot. It's on the side of the house, and it gets so much sun during the day, and probably till about 6:30 at night. So from you know, 10:30 in the morning, it's a...
In a season like this, Dan, you can't predict the season, but in a season like this, your tomatoes probably would have been happier with some afternoon shade. Tomatoes and roses absolutely demand morning sun. They really need to dry off that overnight dew. But if they get that morning sun in a summer like this, where it was a record-breaking heat all through the early part of the summer, it'll still go down as the hottest summer in history, I believe. After 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they're like us. It's time to get off the beach, pal. Right?
I'm with you.
And, you know, many people I've advised who have rooftop gardens or plants are really exposed in full sun. To save them this season, I advise them to set up some shade cloth or some beach umbrellas to give them some shade after 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So that's what your tomatoes need. They don't need that full sun all day. They need 6 to 8 hours of sun beginning first thing in the morning. And if we have another blazer, they can get by with 6 easy, and they would prefer to get some shade in the afternoon.
Sure, sure. Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, good luck, Dan.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
And where is Jim Good?
I'm in Philadelphia, in University City in particular.
Out in West Philadelphia.
That's correct.
Very good. A great old neighborhood near the University of Pennsylvania.
So I brought my houseplants out onto the balcony
right
for the summer. And we're kind of in the treetops, and, you know, the ants come and go. And I was about to repot one of them, and I pulled the plant out of the pot only to find that it had become the home of a whole nest of little ants who were busily scurrying around with their eggs and wondering why this gigantic person is messing with their...
You terrified them, Jim.
I terrified them, I know.
You're this giant monster from West Philly who tore apart their city. You're Godzilla.
Godzilla, really. So... I mean, this is a relatively small plant. I have some of these big ones that I really don't feel like pulling out of their pots. And is there some way for me to transfer these plants indoors without bringing the ants in with them?
Oh, sure. And this is a great time of year to discuss this because a lot of people whose house plants have been on vacation outdoors will need to start prepping them to come inside.
Right.
Now, I will tell you, your situation is unusual. This is generally not the kind of pest problem that we get when plants come back indoors.
Really?
Yes. But I'm sure you destroyed their happy home when you repotted the plant. And I'll also suggest that the plant was not suffering one bit from their presence.
I know.
Mean, ants are ubiquitous. They're also everywhere.
Right.
And it's either ants or termites that are the most numerous creatures on the planet. So, you know, they coexist with a lot of things. They tend not to do any damage. Inside a house, ants can become a problem because they'll get into stored food. But outside, most times, they're considered beneficial because they eat the eggs of some pest insects and they aerate the soil. So they're lightening up your houseplant soil, and you're complaining. You couldn't please some...
Ungrateful wretch that I am.
That's right. You can't please some people if you hung them with a silk rope. What you can do is before you bring your plants inside, go out there and literally flush the soil. Get rid of any saucers that are underneath the plants and just pour water through them to make sure. And if there's any ants in the pots, they will then come rushing to the surface, and you'll know that that's a plant that needs to be repotted or taken care of. But more important than that is to get some sort of a pressurized sprayer or a hose that has like a laser beam setting on the nozzle.
Right.
And rinse off the leaves of your plants.
Ah.
Because that's where bad pests come in. That's where aphids come in and whitefly and mealybugs. And the smartest thing you can do is, like, 3 days before you're ready to bring your plants inside, you're going to add the soil flush because you've had the ant problem, and that's a smart thing to do. But I want you to spray down those leaves, top and bottom. Make sure you just laser beam with water every single leaf. Then leave the plants outside for a couple of days, and then 2 or 3 days later, do it again. And then bring them inside, and ideally you would take them to a kitchen sink or to your bathtub and just inspect them and do any final cleanup. Because you only have to, the ants would not really even be a problem inside, but you bring in one aphid, and by January you have a University of Aphid City going on your houseplants. Same thing. Same thing with whitefly or mealybug or scale. And the answer is not to bring them in the first place. And the plants love this. The plants love being blasted with water, getting their leaves cleaned up, get all that city grit off them before they come back inside.
Sure.
And then, should anything go south on you, and after your plants have been inside for a while, you see ants around, don't panic. Just go out and get some boric acid bait traps typically you'll get like a little bottle of liquid and little cardboard things.
Okay.
And then where you see ants, instead of smashing the ants, you put these little boric acid things down.
Okay.
And they come for the sweet. They get a little bit of boric acid, but it's a low dose that doesn't kill them immediately.
Mm.
They take it back to the nest, and it's like a week before the first ant gets sick.
Got it.
But the next day, all the ants are dead.
Yeah.
And that's the great way, because you're actually getting them to take the poison back to the queen.
Got it.
And ants are a perennial problem in the city in the wintertime, because they come in to escape the cold.
They do.
But boric acid traps get rid of them without any spraying or any kind of toxins.
Okay, that's a great solution. Thank you.
And I'm glad you called, because it really gives our listeners a heads up to wash their plants off before they bring them back inside.
Good.
So thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
All right, you take care, sir.
Bye for now.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, keeping rats far, far away. Alexis Landis, you bet your garden producer, an unratty person, would you please read this week's troubling question?
Sure, Mike. Well, Joyce in Havertown, Pennsylvania writes, Mike, we need help. Last winter, a pair of rats lived in our compost bin. When spring came, we put wire mesh around the bottom of the bin and clumps of used cat litter around the area, and they left. Now they're back, in our compost bin and under a neighbor's shed. Our township put out traps with rat poison and killed a couple of them in the spring. We want to get rid of the rats, but don't want to use poison. I think our cat would be able to get a few. Do you have any suggestions about the rest? I checked in your archives and didn't see anything.
Well, that's because I've been avoiding this topic for fear that people would just turn the radios off and shudder for the rest of the day. But it's too important a topic to avoid. Rats are a huge public health menace, and there are many things that homeowners accidentally do in the fall that invite the vermin to nest nearby. So let's review the basics of rat prevention and eradication. First, rats are too big and strong for cats. You can forget about that one. You'd need a ratting dog like a Jack Russell Terrier. And while rat poison placed inside a trap is fairly safe, such poison should never be used alone or in traps that might not secure the poisoned animal. Poisoned animals seek cover when the first symptoms hit, and then often expire inside the walls or crawl space of a home. The resulting smell is agonizing, and other really nasty pests are attracted to the carcass. Outdoors, poisoned animals can be taken by important predators like hawks and owls, poisoning them in the process. Now, to try and keep the rats at a distance to begin with, if open compost piles are positioned anywhere near a home, shed, or other structure, don't use them to process food waste that attracts creatures like rats, mice, possums, and raccoons. Most kitchen waste adds no nutrition to the finished compost and is better recycled through a worm bin anyway. If food scraps must go outdoors, use a metal compost tumbler or similar device that's sealed and sits up off the ground. Be aware that even food-free compost piles can be attractive to vermin for the heat and shelter they provide. If rats or other vermin are seen near compost, set up a live trap nearby, baited with peanut butter. Only use live capture traps to avoid injuring non-target creatures like cats, birds, and turtles. Numerous brands are available, like Tomahawk and the legendary Have a Heart. But if a rat you capture, don't have a heart. Euthanize the creature as humanely as possible instead. If you can't do that, talk to a local vet who can. Rats are age-old enemies of humankind and should never be released once captured. Don't leave pet food outdoors. Don't put your trash out in plastic bags. Only use metal cans with locking lids. Don't pile firewood up against the side of a house or shed. It creates a perfect place for rats to nest. I made this rookie mistake shortly after we moved into our place in the woods and paid dearly for it. It took me all winter to get them out of the house, every day filled with dread, terror, and some of the worst personal guilt I've ever experienced. If you have a firewood pile anywhere outside, keep a live trap baited with peanut butter next to it and check it every day. If you go away for more than a few days, disengage the trap to protect non-target creatures. and don't leave ladders leaning up against the side of the house. This was my other big rookie homeowner mistake. I was doing a lot of gutter work and left the extension ladder all the way up to the roof overnight. They ran up the ladder, chewed through the soffit, and thus began my winter of extreme discontent. If rats do get into your house, don't panic and use rat poison. Those rats are guaranteed to die inside your walls. If you don't have indoor pets, use spring-type rat traps baited with peanut butter. Rat traps are big, about four times the size of a mouse trap, and they work better when nailed onto a big flat board to keep them stable when they spring. Or use live capture traps baited with peanut butter like outdoors. And keep at it. Never assume that you've trapped them all. If you see signs that some are still around, despite the presence of traps, that would be chewed objects and or their distinctive droppings, wash the traps or get new ones and then handle them with clean gloves so that you don't leave any scent on them. If you can't personally do these kind of things, hire a pest control professional. A real pro will be happy to work with traps alone and will probably do a much better job with them than you could. And finally, if this happens, don't blame yourself and or fall into a state of despair. These creatures arouse some of our most primal fears, and they're smart, strong, agile, and persistent. To defeat them, you need to keep your wits about you and be diligent. Well, that sure was some unnerving but essential information about protecting your family from vicious vermin, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pile me up against the house for the winter if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Like us on Facebook. Put the actual subject in the subject line. Like us on Facebook. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week, find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and or like us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Our newly designed website, check it out. It's the fine work of Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah, she who will not otherwise be named, Kazar. Amenable Amanda McGrath is our social media director. Please help preserve her amenability by liking us on Facebook. Allegorical Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Jovial Joanna Hatzis and Bristly Brett Rader are our production assistants. Alliterative Al Banks is our esteemed editor. I'm your host, mischievous Mike McGrath, and I'll scramble, scamper, and scheme to see you again next week. I'm always telling you to make compost in the fall, but what should you cook your compost in? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll look at the many faces of compost bins. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike helps us cut through the clamor of advice about carnations, climatic.